you, Lord. We bless you and commit our ways to you. Amen. So this portion is also taken from the writings of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. This particular essay is by Menachem Feldman. At any rate, he talks about the Song of Moses from Deuteronomy 32. It's referred to as Heaven and Earth. It contains only 43 verses, he says, yet the song Moses taught the Jews on the last day of his life spans all of Jewish history. From the very beginning, when he found them in a desert land, all the way to the future redemption, when the nations will praise God, for he will appease his land and his people. In the opening phrase, Moses calls for heaven and earth to bear witness. Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. This is taken from Deuteronomy 32:1, and the words give ear, ha'azinu, is the phrase that gives the portion its name. Because Jewish law requires legal matters to be established on the basis of two witnesses, at the least two or three, Moses called upon both heaven and earth to bear witness that he indeed had conveyed this song to the people. The testimony of heaven and earth is more than merely a poetic metaphor. Moses was conveying the profound lesson that in order for the message to endure, the Jews must evoke both heaven and earth. The purpose of the Jewish people, the objective of all Jewish history, is the marriage of heaven and earth. While many spiritual seekers in virtually all religions seek to escape the confines of the flesh and climb heavenward, the Jew is charged with a far more profound calling. First create peace, then build a bridge, and finally marry heaven and earth. Moses uses different words to address the heavens and the earth. He says, give ear, O heavens, ha'azinu, and let the earth hear, v'tishma. Let me let Susanna in. Hello, Susanna. Good to see you. We're in, I guess, the fifth or sixth paragraph. The Hebrew word ha'azinu, give ear, is used specifically when the listener is in close proximity to the speaker. The word tishma here, however, applies to hearing something distant. Indeed, the Midrash explains that Moses was close to the heavens, that is, spiritually, was the reality of his existence. Hence he employed the word ha'azinu when addressing the heavens. The material world, however, was distant and insignificant to Moses, so he used the word tishma when addressing the earth. Moses was close to the heavens, but since the purpose of Judaism is to connect both matter and spirit, Moses had to invoke not only heaven, but the earth as well. We each have a heaven and earth within us. Part of us seeks the transcendent and the spiritual, while another part is drawn to the earthly and the physical. Perhaps more than any other part of the song, the opening words, give ear, O heavens, and let the earth hear, capture the mission of the Jew. The song is read on Shabbat in close proximity to the holidays of Yom Kippur and Sukkot. For Yom Kippur and Sukkot are the embodiment of the song. On Yom Kippur, we reach to the heavens. We connect to the core of our soul and feel unified with God. But just as we reach the climax of the holiness of Yom Kippur, we transition to preparation for the holiday of Sukkot, when we celebrate the physical bounty with which we have been blessed. You shall make for yourselves the festival of Sukkot for 7 days. When you gather in the produce from your threshing floor and your vat, 7 days shall you celebrate the festival to the Lord your God in the place which the Lord your God shall choose. That place, as it turns out, is Jerusalem, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands, and you will only be happy. The combination of Yom Kippur and Sukkot represents the life of the Jew. We are close to heaven. We connect to our angelic, spiritual, and pure soul on Yom Kippur, and then we connect that spiritual awareness to the field to sanctify and uplift the blessings of everyday life. So that is the essay, Menachem's essay. So we'll take a look at some of the comments and look at some of the scripture that embraces them. So, number one is the opening phrase, Moses calls for heaven and earth to bear witness. So, what we're going to talk about is one of the things that we have talked about many times in the past, places in the scripture where a statement is made one way and then somewhere else the opposite statement is made. And so those texts are very important because the scripture in the Hebrew, things like this are said deliberately, right? We'll talk about one of the explanations regarding why that is so, but it's not the only explanation that can help us make sense of the reason why this is done. The Sidra Ha'azinu begins with Moses' great oration. Give ear, you heavens, and let the earth hear. The Midrash, with its usual sensitivity to the nuances of language, notes that Moses seems to be talking in terms of intimacy towards the heavens and of distance towards the earth. There is an almost exactly opposite verse in Isaiah, hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, right? So in the book of Isaiah, the word hear, which is associated with the word earth in Ha'azinu, in the Song of Moses, is associated with the heavens in the book of Isaiah. And the words give ear, Ha'azinu, in the Song of Moses, which is associated with the heavens, is associated with the earth in the book of Isaiah, in which Isaiah expresses closeness to earth and distance from heaven. So it's the opposite of Moses. Moses is close to heaven, distant from the earth. Isaiah is close to the earth, distant from the heaven. That is something suggested just by the language, obviously, not necessarily their respective ministries. But it goes on to say, which path is the Jew to follow? Is he to strive towards heaven and keep himself aloof from worldly events? Or is he, like Isaiah, to find his spiritual home in the things of the earth? And what bearing does this dilemma have on the time in which the Sidra, the portion, is usually read? The 10 days of repentance and the days immediately following Yom Kippur, the supreme moments of self-examination in the Jewish year. So, these are the words of Moses in Deuteronomy 32. Give ear, Ha'azinu, heavens, let the earth hear, Tishma. But if you look at Isaiah 1, hear, Shim'u, but you can see that it's a similar form. It's just, it just has a different prefix and suffix. But if you look at the bolded letters in blue, you can see the word Shema, right? That's the Hebrew word for hear. Shema Yisrael, for example. Hear, O Israel. So, hear, Shim'u, O heavens. Shim'u is the plural. Shema is the singular, O heavens, because the word heavens is plural. Give ear, Ha'azinu, O earth. So the word Ha'azinu, from the root azan, means to listen or to give ear or to discern. And the word tishma or shim'u from the root shama means to hear, to listen to understand, to obey, right? So you can see that both of these words have more to do with just hearing something, right? They have to do with hearing, discerning, understanding, apprehending, obeying, right? In other words, walking in the knowledge of what is heard as opposed to just hearing it, right? Of course, there are many passages in which people are criticized for only seeing with their eyes but not apprehending the significance of what it is that they actually see, or hearing with their ears, but not apprehending the significance of what it is that they actually hear, right? And in Hebrew, other things are added to this too. Tasting is another expression that's used of tasting and determining if whether or not something is good or bitter, right? There are several occasions when words in Hebrew are used like this. But we're going to move on to number two. Because Jewish law requires legal matters to be established on the basis of two witnesses, Moses called upon both heaven and earth to bear witness that he indeed had conveyed this song to the people. So there are several passages that have to do with this. The first is in Deuteronomy 17. On the testimony of two or three witnesses, a person is to be put to death. But no one is to be put to death on the testimony of only one witness, right? So in a situation like this, in a capital case, witnesses had to come forward to testify against the accused. But a person could not be put to death on just the testimony of one witness. They could only be sentenced to death on the testimony of two or three witnesses. And of course, the witnesses were interrogated to make sure that they actually saw what they claimed to see, right? And by the way, if a witness attests to the guilt of an innocent party and that individual is put to death, as in a capital case, if it is later discovered that they falsified their testimony to put this innocent person to death, then they were executed as well. Right? So it tended to be a wonderful deterrent against vocalizing false testimony, vocalizing it, putting it in writing in whatever case it was brought to bear in court. Another passage is in Deuteronomy 19. One witness is not enough to convict anyone accused of any crime or offense that they may have committed. A matter must be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. And I want you to notice the way this principle is applied in the apostolic writings too, as in Matthew 18. If your brother or sister sins, go and point out their fault, just between the two of you. If they listen to you, you have won them over. But if they will not listen, take one or two others along, so that every matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. Now, where did Yeshua come up with this principle of establishing a matter on the basis of two or three witnesses? Is it something he just invented in the apostolic writings or in these gospels? Obviously not. Well, what principle was he applying to this contemporary situation in his day? Obviously, he was applying the principle we find in Deuteronomy 17, Deuteronomy 19, and Numbers 35. So obviously, Yeshua deliberately applies Torah principles or Torah instructions to contemporary circumstances, right? And other apostolic authors do the same thing. In John 8, in the Torah or the law, it is written that the testimony of two witnesses is true. I am one who testifies for myself, Yeshua says. My other witness is the Father who sent me. But look at what Paul writes in 2 Corinthians. This will be my third visit to you. Every matter must be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. This is a quote from Deuteronomy 19:15. I already gave you warning when I was with you the second time. I now repeat it while absent. On my return, I will not spare those who sinned earlier or any of the others. Since you are demanding proof that the Messiah is speaking through me, he is not weak in dealing with you, but is powerful among you. Right? So, another passage is in 1 Timothy 5. This is the advice of Paul to a rabbi leading a messianic synagogue. Do not entertain an accusation against an elder unless it is brought by two or three witnesses. In this verse, and the others cited alongside this one, it is obvious that Paul and others applied Torah instructions to his or to their teaching. Why would they have done this if they believed that the Torah had been done away with in the Messiah? There's no answer to that question because it doesn't make sense, right? There are many passages in which Torah principles are applied in the instruction of all of the apostolic authors. The fact of the matter is that the apostolic writings are full of quotes from the Tanakh, from the Hebrew Bible, from the Torah. But this principle is also something mentioned in Hebrews 10. Anyone who rejected the law of Moses died without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. But there are many other examples too. Financial claims, for example, require two witnesses. This is from the tractate in the Talmud on civil law. Two witnesses are required for both kiddushin, which is the Hebrew word for betrothal, and get, the Hebrew word for divorce, to be valid. This comes from the Talmud as well. A Beit Din, a court of three, oversees conversions, ensuring proper testimony about the candidate's sincerity. If you have ever converted to Judaism, if you have ever been involved with someone who has converted to Judaism, then you have had this experience with a Beit Din, in this case a court of three. These are typically three rabbis from the community who meet together and interrogate those who have spent a year studying Judaism and have made plans or are intend to convert, right? So once their conversion is recognized, the next thing they do is to go through the waters of a mikvah, right? And then they're officially recognized as a member of the Jewish community. Before a widow can remarry, witnesses must confirm her husband's death. By the way, this is something which is still done today, although in our time, for example, to change the names on a document, for example, a deed, if you want to add the name of a husband or a wife to a deed, a property deed, you have to produce a marriage certificate to prove that you and this individual are in fact married. And it can't be done otherwise, right? And the same is true with regard to things that a surviving spouse inherits, right? They have to produce a death certificate to validate the fact that the spouse has in fact passed away. Two witnesses were required to testify before the Sanhedrin regarding the sighting of the new moon. And this is a bit odd when you stop and think about it. We're talking about this on Wednesday evening, but everybody can see the new moon, right? It's not like, oh my goodness, look at that. There's the new moon, right? I mean, the people who go before the Sanhedrin already knows that the new moon has been sighted because they saw it while they were walking to the court, right? They all looked up and all of them saw the new moon. And the new moon in Judaism is that first little sliver of the moon, not the invisible moon like it is in Western culture, right? The new moon is the new moon, that little slice, but you can actually see it. Why do they need testimony that the new moon has appeared? And by the way, these witnesses were interrogated too, to make sure that they actually saw it. The other thing which is true, which is interesting, is new days begin and end when 2 to 3 stars appear in the night sky, right? So that's something which we still practice today. A Jewish day begins at nightfall, not sunset, not when the sun sets, but at nightfall, when it actually gets dark enough to see 2 to 3 stars in the evening sky. And I can remember on many, many past occasions when we would celebrate Yom Kippur with our congregation in the foothills in Northern California, right? We would all break the fast together, and all of the kids were outside waiting for it to be dark enough to see the 3 stars, right? Because when we saw 3 stars, we could break the fast and eat, right? So as the evening skies got darker and darker, more people would go outside to check out the sky and to determine when the fast was officially over. The underlying principle is that important matters affecting people's lives, reputations, or religious status deserved careful, verified testimony rather than casual acceptance of claims. And this is something that we should be sensitive to, regarding the casual acceptance of claims. The casual acceptance of claims should be dismissed until there is meaningful evidence that that something is true. Okay? Number 3. The purpose of the Jewish people, the objective of all Jewish history, is the marriage of heaven and earth. You're familiar, I'm sure, with this passage from Genesis 28. Joseph had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on the earth with its top reaching to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending upon it. This is one of the passages that we talked about. I'm not sure if we talked about it this year, but we certainly talked about it last year when we talked about the teaching of Rabbi Foreman, and we talked specifically about this highway or this stairway resting on the earth, but with its top reaching to heaven. And what's interesting about this vision is that it's quoted by Yeshua in John chapter 1, when he talks to Nathanael. You believe because I told you I saw you under the fig tree? You will see greater things than that. He then added, very truly I tell you, you will see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Which by definition makes Yeshua the stairway that stretches between the heaven and the earth. And it's interesting that the objective of all Jewish history, the purpose of the Jewish people, is to connect the heaven and the earth, And in this situation, this is something facilitated by the Messiah. The Messiah is the one, frankly, the only one who is capable of doing this, who is capable of connecting the heaven and the earth, although that is something we are called to do in our relationship with the Lord and with each other as well. This is emphasized in this passage in Exodus 19. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, he's speaking to the people of Israel, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you are to speak to the Israelites. The idea is that they are supposed to be God's representative to the nations, which is something emphasized, although the whole earth is mine. The whole earth is mine. All of the inhabitants of the planet are mine, right? But I have called you to reach out to them and to draw them into a relationship with me. That is the objective, or one of the most significant objectives or purposes of God's people, Israel. And this is something that Peter repeats in his first letter. But you are a chosen people. He is writing to the Jewish people dispersed among the nations, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession. But, as it turns out, Gentiles who embrace Yeshua as the Messiah are connected to this priesthood too. They're connected to the nation as well, and they're connected to God's special possession. That you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. This is something that he is saying to Israel, not to the Gentiles. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. This is a quote from the book of Hosea, chapter 1, verse 10, and chapter 2, verse 23. So we should not assume it applies to a group of people that it doesn't. In the book of Hosea, it makes it very clear who these words apply to and for what reason. Also, from the book of Revelation, we have a passage. And they sang a new song, for you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. And you have made them a kingdom of priests to our God. This is something that that speaks of God's people being used of the Lord to reach others for the kingdom. By the way, this idea regarding the people of God being a holy nation, I wanted to see how far this extends. And so I came across this statement. Christianity regards itself as a holy nation, drawing directly from the language, notice, originally applied to Israel. So even though the language of God's people being a holy nation before the Lord is originally applied to Israel, the church has taken these terms upon themselves, right? The church regards itself as the spiritual Israel. Early Christians understood the church as inheriting the covenant promises made to Israel, becoming a spiritual nation transcending ethnic boundaries. Universal scope. Unlike ethnic Israel, this holy nation includes a people from every tribe and language and people and nation, as if the people of Israel didn't. And in fact, using the expression ethnic Israel is a misapplication of the term, because Israel included many people of different ethnic identities, right? They weren't just people who were born into one of the tribes of Israel. We'll talk about this in a few more minutes. And their priestly function. just as Israel was called to be a kingdom of priests in Exodus 19, the passage that we read earlier, the church sees itself as having a mediating role between God and the world. The church sees itself as having all of these functions. Now, you can obviously see that the church sees itself as Israel's replacement. Israel has been rejected by God because of their sin. Most prominently, the rejection of the leadership of Yeshua as the Messiah, although that was not true. I mean, Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, members of the great Sanhedrin, they were both believers. They both believed that Yeshua was the Messiah. And, of course, thousands and thousands and thousands of other Jews did, too. In the book of Acts, we have testimony that not only did Pharisees believe, but Sadducees, too. In other words, priests, laymen, people throughout the community believe that Yeshua was the Messiah, right? That's the testimony of the book of Acts. That is obviously not the testimony of the early church fathers, right? Because they are looking for an excuse to see the Israel of God rejected and to see themselves take Israel's place. But I also want to read something from a doctoral thesis that I critiqued in my seminary days. This guy, Harold Dollar, is a PhD. His field is world missions, and he teaches at the Talbot School of Theology, or he did. I don't know what has happened to him since, but the paper that I'm going to quote from is his doctoral thesis. And my term paper for his class was a critique of his doctoral thesis. Okay? Professor Dollar believes that Luke Acts is a missionary story. To scholars devoted to the study of missiology, it is assumed that one can find in Acts missiological guidelines of contemporary relevance. However, there is a difference between discovering missiological guidelines and Acts that have contemporary relevance and saying that he does 2,000 years of Jewish history characterized by particularism were reversed in two short decades by a renewal effort which arose out of the ministry of Yeshua of Nazareth. Of course, I put in the word Yeshua of Nazareth and culminated in the formation of Christianity, and that Luke alone provides the record of how this Jewish movement developed into a universal faith within two decades after the death of its founder. Okay? Now, I added the italics, but one of the things that I wanted to point out has to do with he characterizes the faith of Israel as particularistic, a technical theological term for a faith or a religion that is restricted to a specific group of people and not open to outsiders, which obviously is what the word universal means, right? A universal faith is one that welcomes outsiders. In fact, the word Catholic, if you are, you may be aware of this, but the word Catholic means universal. That's what the word Catholic Church means, the universal church. At any rate, Dollar believes that Luke wrote his gospel in order to prepare his readers for the eventual inclusion of the Gentiles in a universal faith that would replace Judaism. So he happened to be of the replacement school of Christian thought. And Luke wrote Acts in order to complete the record, that is, of the paradigm shift away from the exclusive centripetal particularism of Judaism to the inclusive centrifugal universalism of Christianity. So, centripetal is a word which which has to do with things rotating towards a center, and centrifugal is a word which has to do with things rotating towards the outside. So in other words, Judaism is a particularistic faith, and Christianity is a universal faith. And the particularism of Judaism ensures that the faith of Judaism is only accessible by Jews and not by Gentiles, right? So he goes on to write, according to Dollar, Luke prepared his audience for this paradigm shift by including information in his gospel that deals with the way that Yeshua related to those who were oppressed and marginal to normal Jewish life. By the way, the words I'm reading are from my paper, from my critical analysis of Dollar's thesis, his doctoral thesis. And he believed that Luke's inordinate interest in women, sinners, tax collectors, the poor, the helpless, and Samaritans represents anomalies that conflict with the dominant paradigm of Jewish particularism and prepares the readers for the introduction and acceptance of a new paradigm where Gentile inclusion becomes the accepted norm. Dollar believes his study begins his study by reviewing Yeshua's view of the Gentiles and world mission and some of the features that are unique to Luke's gospel. And right from the start, he points out that Luke's major emphasis on a mission to the Gentiles is made not by explicit statements about a Gentile mission, but by a selection of materials that emphasize Yeshua's ministry to those considered marginal in Palestinian society. Now, I'm not sure if you're aware of it or not, but there is no such thing as Palestinian society, certainly not in biblical times. If you look at the footnote in the bottom, that's why I have the word crossed out. He should have written Israeli society, because Israeli society did exist in biblical times, and it obviously exists today. The expression Palestinian society is anachronistic, not in the correct time, reference. In the first century of the Common Era, the land was known as the Land of Israel. The land was connected to the province of Syria and called Syria-Palestina by Caesar Hadrian at the conclusion of the Bar Kokhba revolt in 135. It was named after Israel's long-term rivals, the Philistines. Palestine has never been the designation of an autonomous nation in the land of Israel, right? But you can see his replacement thought. And by the way, the replacement thought of everyone who refers to Israel in the first century, not as Israel, but as Palestine, right? Because it wasn't named Palestine for over 100 years after Yeshua's presence in the land. At any rate, in other words, Dollar tries to demonstrate that, number one, first century Judaism was characterized by exclusive particularism. Number two, in his gospel, Luke prepares his readers for the eventual inclusion of the Gentiles alongside Jews in a new faith that would replace Judaism. And three, Luke does this deliberately, not by making explicit statements about a Gentile mission per se, but by demonstrating that Judaism, because it is particularistic, could not enfranchise those in the community who were oppressed and marginal to Jewish life without forcing them to adapt to Jewish particularism in the process. As Dollar himself points out when he discusses the cultural implications of the Jerusalem Council decision regarding Gentiles, even Jews are not saved by being Jews, he says. Peter concludes that circumcision not only has nothing to do with the salvation of Gentiles, it also has nothing to do with the salvation of Jews. So, these are the references in my analysis of Dollar's thesis here, and these are some of the references that go along with it. But these are a couple of observations. If the concluding statement above is true, then the salvation was of Gentiles was always something connected or facilitated in Judaism and doesn't need a Christianity to facilitate. The fact is, Tamar, the mixed multitude, the strangers who sojourned among the people of Israel when they left Egypt, Rahab, Ruth, Naaman the leper, Bathsheba, the many people of other nations who became Jews in the book of Esther, the woman of Samaria, the Syrophoenician or the Canaanite woman in the Gospels, Cornelius, the Ethiopian eunuch, and the many Gentiles who were connected to synagogues in the book of Acts, those who were not circumcised, if they had been, they would have been regarded as Jews and not Gentiles. So all of the Gentiles that Paul preaches to in the book of Acts, if they're referred to as Gentiles, then they are Gentiles who have not yet converted to Judaism. And there is no indication in the book of Acts that they ever will, right? And the reason why there's no indication in the book of Acts that they never will is because there's no reason to. In other words, Gentiles were welcome to sojourn besides the people of Israel, and they have been by the time of the book of Luke. They had been for 1,500 years, right? 1,500 years. There are four Gentiles in the genealogy of Yeshua. I mean, why would any of that be permitted? Why would a mixed multitude be allowed to leave Egypt with the people of Israel on the night that the Exodus took place if Israel, if Judaism was not a universalistic religion and not a particularistic religion, as Dollar and everyone involved in Christianity contends, right? In other words, they all, to a person, assume that Christianity is what is needed to make sure that Gentiles can be connected to the people of Israel, but that is not the testimony of the apostolic writings. That is the testimony of the church fathers, but not the testimony of the apostolic writings. Why bring any of this up? Well, primarily because of what was just mentioned, is that the mission of the Jew is to connect heaven and earth. That has been the mission of the Jewish people from time immemorial, right? From the very first Jew. The very first Jew is regarded as Abraham. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They lived thousands of years ago. And you may be aware of the fact that they did a good deal of work among the Gentiles in drawing the Gentiles to the God of Israel, right? And of course, there are many rabbinic references to the fact that the Jewish people were scattered among the nations primarily to have an impact among the Gentiles. In other words, read the book of Jeremiah, Isaiah, and Ezekiel, and you tell me why the Jewish people were scattered among the nations, right? You can read it casually. You don't even have to study the material. You can read it casually to discern that the people were vomited out of the land because of their sin, right? I mean, I can't think of a concept that is more clearly described than that one in the Bible. But that's not the view of the rabbis. Of course, they acknowledge that that is the case, but that's only a you know, the exile is just an effect of the cause, right? The effect is their exile. The cause is their sin. But that's not the reason they talk about this. They talk about it because of the mission he has given God's people to reach out and to draw the Gentiles into a relationship with him. Now, this isn't something which is talked about by many people. It's not something which is referred to in many synagogues by many rabbis. Although, I remember on one occasion when Rabbi Jeremy Gimpel came to our congregation in Sonora, in the Sierra foothills in Northern California, and one of the things which he happened to share with our group is the first time I ever heard another rabbi say these words besides me. He referred to the fact that Israel, he quoted from Exodus 19, was to be a nation of priests. They were supposed to be a community of people who fulfilled a priestly function in their relationship with Gentiles, in their relationship with other nations, right? And as believers, when Gentiles embrace Yeshua as Messiah, that becomes part of their mission too. Why? Because they're connected to the covenants that God made with Israel. They're connected to the promises that God made with Israel, or to Israel. They're connected to the people of Israel. They are wild olive branches grafted in among the natural branches of the people of Israel. Paul's illustration from Romans 11, right? Jewish branches aren't grafted into a church. Gentile branches are grafted into the people of Israel because there is no church in the apostolic writings. There is a church in the mind and in the hearts of the early church fathers, which is where church theology comes from, but not the text, right? So this idea is important, particularly as we look at this statement concluding the Gospel of Matthew. Yeshua tells his disciples, therefore, and go make disciples of all nations. Is he telling his disciples this as Jews or as Christians? Given the fact that there were no Christians at the time he spoke these words, right? No one would have known what a Christian was, right? Or where they came from, or where they were going. He's saying this to his Jewish disciples, and he's calling them to make disciples of all nations, which obviously means more than bringing them into a relationship with God, right? Decisions to follow the Messiah and discipling people are two very, very different things, right? He says, baptizing them or facilitating their immersion, because in the first century, people didn't have anyone baptize them. They baptized themselves. An attendant made sure that they went completely underwater, but they weren't dunked by someone else. And teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you, and surely I am with you always to the very end of the age, right? By the way, this passage in Deuteronomy 30 speaks of the fact that the Torah is observable. Yeshua taught that until heaven and earth disappear, the Torah isn't going anywhere. And Yeshua, in his statement teaching us how to pray, mentions this as well. This then is how you should pray. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, and your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Again, the connection in the scriptures between heaven and earth and the responsibility that we have to facilitate that connection, right? we have the responsibility of facilitating the connection between heaven and earth, the connection between things which are spiritual and things which are practical and real. And, of course, we should treasure this world and treasure God's design of it and see to it that it's preserved and safeguarded and exists, continues to exist, to prosper, right? I mean, frankly, it's a stain on mankind that so many animals have become extinct, right? I mean, obviously we're not the ones who control the destruction of the dinosaurs, but I appreciate the efforts that are now being undertaken to bring species of animals that are almost extinct back to life. And that is happening in many cases, right? Now that people are taking responsibility to see to it that this is done. But these are things that we have to undertake in greater measure. At any rate, this passage from 1 Corinthians speaks to this as well. Notice number G, the extension, the ideal of the religion of the rabbi was the extension of God's kingship over all the peoples of the world, which is obviously something that we will see when the Messiah comes, but we should be attempting to do that now. And then number four, which is the last part of this teaching, has to do with the connection, again, between heaven and earth, between what we do on Yom Kippur and what we do on Sukkot, and the recognition that we are made in the image of God, right? So we are a living, breathing soul, a person with a body of flesh and blood. So by definition, we have a connection to God and a connection to this world. And somehow we have to learn to make our home in both until the Messiah comes and establishes his kingdom. Okay, I'm going to stop here. I realize I went a few minutes over, but I'll stop here and see if there are any comments or questions about what we've discussed and about some of the information that we did not get a chance to talk about. Anybody?
A question?
Yes.
Dear David, there's still Jewishness in my mother's side. My dad's Jewish.
Yeah.
My mom's not. But I got a email or something from them that said, oh, that was in my mother's side. Ross, Brown, Simmons, Skyler, and Burke, what's the name? Burke. Now, are those Jewish? Because I keep hearing words, you're in judgment. Fire. Yeah, is that Jewish, or should I don't understand.
The judgment doesn't have anything to do with being Jewish or not Jewish.
Okay.
I mean, you know, the judgment has to do with the wicked. Both Jews.
Okay.
Jews are sometimes wicked and Gentiles are sometimes wicked. Right? Like we read just a few minutes ago, Jews are not saved by being Jews. And
right.
Gentiles are not lost because they're Gentiles.
Right. So is the name that came up with or that showed on the program of the Jewish name?
Well, if your father was Jewish and your mother was yes. not, then you would not be considered Jewish by most Jews. Although in the Reform movement, they do regard a father's Jewishness as evidence of Jewishness. So if you were a member of a Reform synagogue, you would be regarded as Jewish because your father was Jewish, but not in a conservative or a Orthodox synagogue and not by the nation of Israel.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep. Very good. Thank you, Viola. Any other comments before we go?
Bob, it's Roderick here.
Yes, go ahead.
Just a small insight, because this was something Melody and I were talking about earlier today, and it connects with the number 18 in Hebrew, which is associated with Chi.
Yes.
Or, and 18 is comprised of, in the Hebraic thought, is comprised of the number 8 and the number 10. And the number 8 is understood as a connection or a symbol, a reflection of earthly matters, the realm in which all of us live in. And the number 10 is reflective of the heavenly realm. And so this idea that the mission of Israel is to connect heaven and earth is wrapped up in that idea of the number 18, or Chi, and how that is all wrapped together in that way.
Yeah.
And what brought that on, we were watching a documentary recently on a place in northwest New Mexico called Chaco Canyon. And it's a delightful documentary narrated by the late Robert Redford.
Hmm.
And you can find it on Prime. And the reason why I'm mentioning this is because Chaco Canyon is a very mysterious... In the canyon are these mysteriously built dwellings by a people that lived more than 1,000 years ago. And based on archaeological research, these people lived there for 12 generations, and then they were gone. They relocated. They left. But during the time that they were there, there was this very intrinsic, purposely led construction that has left a lot of people amazed. And what was interesting about Chaco Canyon and what archaeologists have found is that four of the main buildings that was left by these folks are perfectly aligned with the solar calendar. And the other buildings are perfectly aligned with the moon and the lunar calendar, which, if you think about it, Islam is a total lunar calendar, and Western culture is a total Gregorian or solar calendar, but only in Israel, on the Hebrew calendar, does it embrace both the lunar and the solar. So what's that all about?
Yeah.
Well, what they discovered, and not only in the excavation and the work, archaeological work in Chaco Canyon, but in astrological studies, or astronomy, I should say, not astrological, but astronomy studies, the moon, we know about its phases every 28 to 29 days, but in terms of the lunar pattern of the moon rising and setting, it's every 18 years. Now, I thought that was a really interesting pattern, and that really was not fully understood until they were excavating and doing the archaeological research at Chaco Canyon, that it became apparent, because these people, more than 1,000 years ago, was actually mapping and tracing the patterns of the moon and how that it recycles the patterns of its rise and fall on the horizon is repeated every 18 years.
Hmm.
And there was just this really interesting idea of how that the moon represents the cycles of time, or time in a cyclical way, whereas the sun represents time in a linear way. And it is the combination of cyclical and linear time in which we find life. And it was just so interesting in how that program we were watching and some of the discoveries, to me, seemed to tie in with this Parsha study. And the idea of 18 and the idea of heaven and earth. And that was very much a part of Chaco Canyon, was the connection between heaven and earth. A lot of the drawings and the petroglyphs that are there show relationships or the interactions or the integrations between heaven and earth. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if there were some Jewish archaeologists that went there to do some studies?
Yeah.
Maybe these folks were actually Hebraic and they were communicating through their architectural precisions a message. But anyway, it's an observation and it's a comment, and so thank you for that.
Very good. Thanks, Roderick. Is Chaco Chaco?
I believe it. Yeah, I have to go back and look because I'm not looking at it right now. I think it's Chaoco, Chaco Canyon.
Okay,
it's
good.
It's on the Amazon Prime streaming service.
Yeah.
And if you're a subscriber, you don't have to pay extra for it. It's a part of the plan.
Right. It's one of their documentaries.
Yeah, it's one of their documentaries. Chaco Canyon.
Okay, good.
A very interesting and delightful watch.
Yeah, I'll check it out. Very good. Thank you. I have a couple of comments, but I wanted to welcome Rebecca. Rebecca has joined us. Rebecca is a friend I can't believe it. I hate when this happens. Anyway, Rebecca is joining us for the first time, so welcome, Rebecca. It's good to have you. I'll think of it in a couple of minutes. But in the meantime, though, something that is interesting is that if this community existed, if they left these remains 1,000 years ago, and they were there for 12 generations, depending upon how long a generation is, that's approximately 400 to 500 years, right? Well, it is very possible that this is a community of Anusim, which are hidden Jews. When the expulsion edict was issued in 1492, there were Jews who left Spain and went to South America, right? They went to Colombia. And as the Inquisition followed them to Colombia, they made their way to other places. One of the places that some of those hidden Jews ended up was in the southern part of the United States, in some of the areas of New Mexico, where New Mexico, contacts, the border is connected with Mexico. At any rate, this would be one of the areas where some Anusim settled. So it's very likely, based upon some of the things that Roderick shared with us, that this was a community of hidden Jews, and they obviously, their objective was to hide their identity so they wouldn't be subject to the to interrogation by the church's inquisitors, right? So this is something that that happened in other places too, but this southern part of the United States, southwestern part of the United States, is where some of them settled. So, good. Thank you, Roderick. I'm going to check that documentary out. It sounds interesting. There's a couple of chats, too, that I didn't get to. I think I did get to the one from Shelley and another one, a Shabbat Shalom from Beth Ann, but here's one from Susanna. Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Can you explain a bit how heaven and earth can be witnesses? I never really understood that, as they are not human. Reading some commentary on Isaiah 53, it spoke about the asham sacrifice, the guilt offering, or the guilt sacrifice being different from the sin sacrifice, not really understanding, since both involve blood. Can you explain? Lastly, just a comment. Judaism, I've experienced, prides itself as not making proselytes, yet in our lesson today, we see that at one time. And that was certainly true in the first century. There are statements that mention it in the apostolic writings. It did happen, was encouraged until it became too dangerous, I have read, and that's correct. Correct me if I'm wrong. That part is correct. In other words, converting to Judaism was something that was encouraged, but that stopped being encouraged when the church was legalized by Constantine in the first third of the fourth century, and it became like a capital crime to convert to Judaism, right? A Christian could not marry a Jewish person. A Christian could not attend a synagogue. A Christian could not involve a Jewish doctor for treatment. They could not go to a Jewish midwife to participate in the birth of a child. They could not do all kinds of things. It was against the law in the Roman Empire after the church is legalized. The idea regarding heaven and earth being a testimony, this is probably not easy to understand, but Hebrew tends to use parts of the body and statements like this one regarding the earth and the heaven in ways that seems to transcend their figurative use or expression. Like, for example, the statement I made earlier, the ongoing sin of God's people in the land made the land sick to its stomach, and the land vomits out the people of Israel into exile, right? Now, obviously, the land doesn't have a stomach, and the land doesn't get sick to its stomach because of something that it ate, right? But the language is very descriptive. The language is very, we sometimes refer to it as a romantic language because it includes descriptions of eyes and ears and noses and mouths, you know, and legs and feet and hands and heavens and earth. And it uses all these things in its application of principles or ideas. It always has these types of descriptions exist in modern Hebrew too. But for example, do you remember when Moses asks the Lord not to turn aside from going before them into the land, right? God says, you know, Moses, I've had it up to here with this people. You lead them into the promised land. And Moses intercedes on behalf of the people and says, no, Lord, we can't go if you don't go before us. So the Lord says his presence will go with them. But the word in Hebrew is face. My face will go with you, right? Whenever you see the word presence in the Hebrew Bible, it's most frequently a translation of the Hebrew word for face, panim, panim, face, right? But it's translated as presence because, you know, God's face going before a people doesn't make a good deal of sense, to Westerners, to English readers, right? So it's always translated dynamically, which I suppose it should be, but when it is, then it strips some of the expression from the way the words are used, right? And diminishes a person's ability to determine when an expression like this, an idiomatic expression like this, is employed, right? So, the heavens and the earth, I mean, have you ever used the expression or heard the expression, if these walls could talk, right? It assumes that the walls absorb, right, some of the events that take place within the rooms, right, that they surround. I don't know to what extent that is or isn't true, but the point is that in Hebrew, things that are not people have the ability to attest to things as well, right? I mean, I hope you're not expecting a technical explanation of how the heaven and the earth can attest to things, because I don't have one to give you, right? With regard to these sacrifices, the guilt offering, the trespass offering, or the offering for rebellious behavior, the sin offering, there are various types of sacrifices mentioned in the book of Leviticus, but interestingly, the sacrifice that is the one that's typically mentioned is the chatat, the sin offering sacrifice. But it's offered for, you know, sins permitted ignorantly, ignorant sin, right? In other words, as you go about your daily routine and discover that you behaved inappropriately or did something wrong that you should not have done, then you can have that sin forgiven by taking a sacrifice to the temple or to the tabernacle, to the priest, unless you have the capability of slaughtering the animal yourself in the prescribed way and having that sin forgiven, right? What's interesting about Isaiah 53, where this passage is mentioned, is the Messiah does pay the price, not only for our sin, but for our guilt, for our wickedness, for our rebelliousness too. Right? So, all of the words for sin are used in this passage in Isaiah 53 as a part of the forgiveness that the Messiah extends as a result of his singular sacrifice, cleanses us from everything that separates us from God, right? So that's the best way to understand that. Okay? Good. Thanks, Susanna. There's a couple of other comments, too. Does the phrase yoke of heaven in Matthew 11:28, Yeshua encouraging to take my yoke, refer to Torah acceptance? Yes. The yoke of heaven does express the idea of taking the yoke of God's instructions upon you, right? But one of the things that the rabbis say is that we must have a relationship with God before we take upon ourselves the yoke of heaven. And heaven in this passage is an evasive synonym for God, right? So, if this statement were recorded in the book of Luke, it probably would have said the yoke of God. But the yoke of heaven and the yoke of God are the same thing, and it's the yoke of taking God's instructions, His word, upon ourselves, that we embrace as a result, not a cause, a result of our relationship with God, right? So, Yeshua would have been that saying the exact same thing about what he expected of his disciples, right? A disciple is intended to follow the instructions of their masters. That's the way it works. Very good. Thank you, Rivka. Here's a statement, a comment from Ed. It's Chaco, C-H-A-C-O, and he has the internet address if you are interested in seeing that documentary about these. I would guess at some future point they will be identified as Anusim, as hidden Jews. But it's interesting to see. We'll see what happens as they continue to excavate. Also from Rivka, thanks Ed, appreciate the reference. I was informed by the three witnesses for my Beit Din that proselytes keep Judaism alive, keep it going to this very day. This is an important concept, and if it's okay, I'd like to share a little story. I don't know how many of you have been to Israel, but when you visit places like the Garden of Gethsemane or the garden opposite the Garden of Gethsemane in Jerusalem, there are many very, very old olive trees on the Mount of Olives. It is said of some of them that they are 1,500 to 2,000 years old, right? But one of the interesting things about them is that olive trees, when they deteriorate from the inside out, right? So what happens is that you can walk up to some of these olive trees, which are huge. You can't wrap your arms around the trunk because they're so big, they're so large. But many of them are hollowed out, right? So they happen to be places where squirrels and owls and other animals, they take refuge in these hollowed out sections of these trees. Well, what happens eventually is that they will eventually die, right? Because the interior of the tree will disintegrate. It deteriorates to a place where it can't support the life of the tree. What's interesting about this is that I knew a botanist who shared something very interesting with me. One of the things that they do to an old and aging oak tree that is dying is they graft wild olive branches into it, right? This is one of the things that they do. And the reason why they do this is because the presence of the wild olive branch reinvigorates the olive tree to nourish it, right? But in the process of nourishing this grafted-in olive branch, it obviously nourishes the olive tree itself. So they sometimes use this method to bring dying olive trees back to life. Now, there may be a point at which the olive tree has deteriorated to such a place that they can't be brought back to life. I don't remember talking with him about that, but he did share with me that that's what they do with olive trees is that they graft wild branches into the tree, and somehow the olive tree recognizes the placement of these new branches into it and revives the tree to life as it supplies those branches their nourishment. The entire tree gets re-nourished. So that's the idea behind what Rivka just shared. I was informed by three witnesses before my Beit Din. So Rivka obviously underwent a conversion procedure. She went before a Beit Din, and they told her, these three rabbis mentioned that proselytes keep Judaism alive and going to this very day, right? So what the rabbis told her is an illustration of this idea regarding the revitalization of an olive tree. And of course, in the scripture, Israel is the olive tree. She also writes, here's a perspective. Abraham and Sarah converted 300 plus souls. If Abraham is a worldwide role model as the patriarch for being the first Jew, doesn't it stand to reason for each follower or claimed Abraham to be a convert, to convert 300 plus souls to Judaism through action and not words, or aim to try? Yes, I agree that we should be like Abraham and Sarah. We should be hospitable people. We should be people who respect others and who extend care to them and who introduce them to the God of Israel. Something that Abraham and Sarah did, and I think that's something that God expects of his people, right? So evangelism is not a Christian idea either. Their methodology associated with evangelism is Christian. But that is not the way Jews are taught to reach out to people using those methods. So our type of evangelism is different. But as you can see by what Rivka just wrote and, you know, throughout the Hebrew Bible, frankly, people did reach out and did connect Gentiles to the covenant and to the promises that God gave his people. And it's something that we've always done. And there have always been people who come to the Lord but don't convert to Judaism, like Naaman the leper, for example, right? He goes home back to Syria. Who knows what happens to him in Syria? But there's no evidence that he converts to Judaism. Very good. Thanks, Rivka. I guess that was the last of those. Anybody else before we go?
A comment, Bob, on the discussion that Rivka brought up about the proselytes keeping Judaism alive. A couple of proselytes that come to mind. One is Onkelos, who is a convert, and his writings came at a very pivotal time in Israel's history. And is, as you know, a resource that we go to have a closer understanding to how Torah was interpreted and how Torah was understood in very ancient days. And then another person that comes to mind is Obadiah, the prophet, a convert from Edom.
Yeah.
Edomites, who was an arch enemy of Israel. And he's a convert and becomes a Jewish prophet and a contributor to the Tanakh.
Yes, absolutely. Very, very good. Onkelos, by the way, was the author of the Targum that bears his name. It's an Aramaic translation of the Hebrew, originally done orally, but then eventually committed to writing. His Targum is regarded as the most authoritative, and it's very interesting, of course. Another convert to Judaism is Rabbi Akiva. Akiva was a convert too, right? He's regarded as one of the greatest rabbis from the Second Temple, from the period in the aftermath of the Second Temple. So, yeah, there are many non-Jews who have converted to Judaism and have made a profound impact in Judaism. So, very good. Good. Anybody else before we go? Is this...
I have one thing.
Okay.
I was praying to Hashem. I heard, hey, or Shaw. I can't remember. And instantly I remembered Akiva and his wife were so poor that they had no money. But a stranger came to his door and told his wife was giving birth and they gave him some of his hay. And then he told his wife, there's even people giving more poorer than we are. Is that what he wants to tell me?
That's a true story that's told about Akiva, yeah. Right? So essentially they gave someone something they needed, even though it was a sacrifice for them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We talked about that two or three weeks ago. I shared that story. So. So very good. Thank you. From Susanna, another comment. I invited a friend from a church, Christian background, to the Yom Kippur service, which she thoroughly enjoyed. She asked me if the rabbis encourage, teach a personal relationship with God. To my shame, I was at a loss. The one thing I could think of was Abraham and the patriarch, who all had personal relationships with God and follow in their footsteps. This seemed to be an unsatisfactory answer to her. Can you provide your thoughts or give examples? I know there are more examples, but seemed to be at a loss at her question. No, she was coming from a Christian perspective and accepting Yeshua and having a personal relationship with him. The rabbis do emphasize a personal relationship with God. There are too many references, frankly, for me to identify them. But if you are interested in some, you could listen to the seminar or to the workshop on Pirkei Avot. Pirkei Avot is a rabbinic work, The Ethics of the Fathers. It's available from the website. And there are many references in Pirkei Avot to having a personal relationship with God and the way a personal relationship with God works. When I mention taking upon yourself the yoke of the kingdom of heaven, I specifically mention that the rabbis taught that you first have to have a relationship with God, and then you take upon yourself the yoke of the kingdom of heaven, right? So, the yoke of Torah is not a yoke which produces salvation. You have to be saved first before the yoke of heaven plays any meaningful role in your life, right? That's just kind of the way it works. So there are many references to this. There might be, if you look at your notes, one of the things that I did not get to in your notes was this item G on the last page. The ideal of the religion of the rabbi was the extension of God's kingship over the peoples of the world, and the Jews had a constant reminder of it in the regulation, a benediction which contains no reference to the divine kingship is no benediction. In other words, when we say a blessing over wine, or when we say a blessing over bread, or when we say a blessing in the sukkah, all of our blessings begin with the words, Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Ha'olam, King of the Universe, not Melech Yisrael. Right? In other words, King, the Lord is not just the King of Israel, he's the King of all nations, right? And the rabbis taught that if you don't understand that God is the King of all people, you don't understand, right? You don't get what a relationship with God is all about, right? That's kind of the way it works. So, I'll defer to the seminar on Pirkei Avot if you wanted a specific example of a rabbinic expression. From Rivka, a marvelous example for proselytes is Joshua, first thing to conquer, enter the land by conquest, is bringing Rahab and her family into the promised land. Right? That's correct. I talked about Rahab earlier. She was already in the promised land, and yet she was allowed to come into the land as the first proselyte with her family. We enter the land with proselytes from the very beginning, right? But, as I mentioned, there was also the mixed multitude that left Egypt with the people of Israel, right? Their children entered the promised land with the people of Israel, too. So, there have always been Gentiles connected with the people of Israel in different capacities. There has never been a time in Jewish history, beginning with Abraham, that there haven't been Gentiles connected to the people of Israel. Because it was always a universalistic faith, not a particularistic faith. Right? So, Christians who hold that view hold it in error. And of course they do so by suggesting that the text means things that it doesn't say. Anybody else before we go? Anyone? Thank you, Rivka. Appreciate the comment. Anyone? Okay. Very good. If there are no other comments or questions, then I guess I will say Laila Tov, good night, may the Lord be with you, Shabbat Shalom. I won't be able to say that probably in a month or so. It's getting dark much earlier than it used to. But I can say it still. It's close to nightfall, but another 45 minutes. So, Shabbat Shalom, and also Shavuot Tov. May the Lord bless you with a wonderful week, and hopefully you'll have an opportunity to spend a little time in a sukkah this week. But we will be having our Wednesday and Thursday night studies this week, right? So, we will be having our Wednesday night and Thursday night studies. I will be doing it from our sukkah, my sukkah. I'll be outside in the sukkah when I do it. So I'll have to make arrangements to make that possible. So, very good. God bless you guys. May the Lord be with you. Bye for now.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.
God bless you.
Recording stopped.